Well, I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Dr. Terry Jernigan. And Terry is currently the director of the Center for Human Development here at UCSD. She's been in the Department of Psychiatry for about 25 years, and as recently had received an appointment in the Department of Cognitive Science to direct the Center for Human Development. Now, Terry's a pretty illustrious person, as I think you'll see after her talk. She was the first person, actually, to do a research study using MRI and morphometry in humans. Terry and I go way back. We actually co-authored, I think, the first paper that was ever done in children using structural MRI. We actually worked out techniques that would allow us to get those kids into a scanner and get them to stay still, and Terry had all the techniques for how to actually analyze the brain morphometry. And subsequently, she's played a major role in the field of neuroimaging, primarily structural imaging, and today she's going to tell us about her work. So Terry has joined the center, the TDLC. She's going to be working across many of the networks, and we have a funded project together, which she'll tell you about as well.
Okay. First, I want to thank the Center for inviting me today, Gary and Paula. I presume that they have invited me because they see that there are some parallels between the goals of the research program that we're trying to develop in the Center for Human Development and the goals that this center has, particularly with regard to identifying the role of timing. So you'll be the judge of that. I'm going to try to focus your attention now on a very different time scale, and that is the time scale of human brain development, quite different from the time scales you've been hearing about in earlier talks. But to begin to do that, what I want to do is to give you a little kind of whirlwind tour through what the story that has developed since the advent of MRI, since the first opportunity really to look at brain structure in typically developing children, to tell you sort of where we started and how far this approach has taken us to really identifying the critical questions that we have now going forward to understand cognitive development in children and learning in children. So first of all, let me start by telling you what the view was when I entered the field, which was just before MRI became available. We were taught, actually, that although it was well appreciated that that there was this exuberant postnatal process of oligodendrocyte differentiation and myelination of the brain fiber tracts over the first few years of life, that really the brain's structure was essentially adult-like by the time kids were about 5 or 6 years of age. That is, the hardware of the brain was considered to be pretty much set by the time they were 5 or 6. And it was well appreciated that there were only very small differences in sort of cranial vault or head circumference past that time. So people interpreted this to mean that the brain's growth was complete. And so people basically were taught that brain morphology or the hardware, the brain structure, was stable through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. But it was well understood that at some point later in life, there were some regressive changes, some kind of cerebral atrophy that set in. And this was really what people were focused on at the beginning. But really, you know, an opportunity to look at this question in detail only became available when MRI was, when it was possible for us to do MRI in normal volunteer groups from across the lifespan. And this is just a set of images it's actually sort of a more recent set of images from the NIMH brain development study. And I don't know if you guys are used to looking at MRI scans. These are just different kinds of MRI and different views of the brain. But even if you're an expert at looking at these, if you're an expert neuroradiologist or an anatomist, you could certainly be forgiven for mistaking this brain for an adult brain, because most of the morphological features that you can see in this set of brain scans is very similar to what you see in adult brains. And in fact, there's so much individual difference variability from one individual to the next that it would be quite difficult to visually identify, for example, to predict exactly the age of this individual. And so really, it remained for us to develop this set of techniques, which are collectively referred to now as MR morphometry techniques, for us to begin to develop quantitative models of morphological parameters, morphological characteristics, and really to look in detail at the lifespan changes that occurred in these morphological parameters. And there, by now, I'm sure most of you know that there's a broad school of techniques that are developed for this, ranging all the way from very heavily supervised, essentially tracing methods for studying individual brain structures, all the way to very sophisticated and intelligent computational morphometry techniques that rely heavily on priors and probabilistic atlases to perform, to model morphological features. And this is just an example to show you that all of these techniques, in one way or another, have to deal with these basic problems. They have to identify the actual brain. They have to reduce some artifacts that are present in the images. All of them attempt to classify the different tissue compartments in the brain, the gray matter, white matter, and CSF. And of course, everybody's interested in particular parts of the brain, so everybody has to do additional anatomical segmentation of some sort. They have to decide where certain brain structures end and other ones begin. And this is just an example set of images from my laboratory. This set of methods that we applied in the lab for a number of years sort of right in the center of this range of methods from the heavily supervised to the computational. But at any rate, the point is just to show you that these are the kinds of measurements that we get. So estimates of the cortical volume in the different cerebral lobes, of the underlying white matter, of, for example, the... let me get my pointer going here. Figure out where it is. I got it. Okay, so we're also looking at the volumes of some of the deep subcortical gray matter structures here in the basal ganglia and in the mesial temporal lobe, and so on. So just to remind you, when we began to apply these methods in people across the lifespan, these were our predictions. We thought that there would be adult brain structure in school-aged children, that these structural characteristics would be stable until some point in old age, and we were interested in looking at in finding that deflection in the data that occurred in older people so that we could differentiate sort of benign aging, brain aging, from the more malignant forms of aging like Alzheimer's disease. And so this, just to show you some data that we collected early on that are just, here's just a global estimate of the cerebral gray matter volume normalized for cranial vault volume. And this is what we expected to see, and this is what we actually observed. And I think you can see right away that not only was there never a point during the lifespan when this particular parameter appeared to be stable, but the changes were never more dramatic than they were early in the age range. And so these observations that Paula alluded to really refocused the field on this early part of the age range, and people began to do a lot more structural imaging studies of kids as they were developing. And now I'm going to fast forward. A lot of work has been... Yes? Well, I think it'd be hard to say from there, and I think that's the answer to that question is very complicated. So if you could hold it, we can go on. Now, since that time, as I said, a number of different techniques have been used to model these effects, and this is sort of everybody's favorite summary slide, and these are data from Jay Geed's program at the NIMH, and this is a mixed cross-sectional and longitudinal study. And what's being shown here is the pattern of cortical thinning across this age range from 5 to 20 years of age. And you can see that here a thinner cortex is blue. And you can see that at 5 years of age, the cortices of the primary sensory motor areas are thinner. And that this thinning sort of spreads out with age into the secondary and tertiary parts of the cortex. But actually, in a few studies... I don't know why it's so hard. There we go. Here's a study done by Elizabeth Soule, who was here with us as a graduate student, and when she was at UCLA, where she did an actually completely longitudinal study. She looked at a group of kids at 7 and then again at 9 years of age. And she showed the same thing, actually, that there were these widespread apparent cortical thinning effects throughout the cortex. But what she also observed was much more limited areas in the perisylvian region, shown here in white, of actual thickening of the cortex. So the plot thickens, so to speak. And I also, these are some data that actually are older than the ones I just showed you. These are from, again, from the set of data that we collected here when Elizabeth was for her dissertation project. And the reason I'm showing, these are some old VBM type analyses. And they were comparing groups of kids. In this case, kids on average 8 years to 14 years of age. And over here, the same group of 14-year-olds or average 14-year-old kids to young adults, 26 years old. Excuse me. And the reason I want to show you these is to point out, first of all, that we were really struck by the amount of continuing, these are like little blobs of gray matter areas that show significant age increases or differences between these two age groups. And you can see this sort of dramatic continuing change in the dorsal parts of the frontal lobe, even late after adolescence. But really, this is why I'm showing you this picture, and that's it. Deep in the center of the brain, these deep gray matter structures are shown here in green, and they also were showing quite a lot of change in apparent volume from adolescence to young adults.
Do those blobs mean they're growing or
shrinking? Excuse me. Thank you. Yes. Okay, and this is just zooming in on this. Here are our estimates of the volume of the thalamus. As you all know, it's a large gray matter structure in the middle of the brain, which interacts very strongly with the cerebral cortex. And you can see here this fairly dramatic change early in life, in the teens and early adulthood, in the apparent volume of the thalamus. And here's the nucleus accumbens, which is a part of the basal ganglia that's been strongly implicated in reward system function, also showing a lot of change in this age range. Now, just to show you that not everything shows exactly the same age curve, here are the data in the hippocampal volume. And this pattern has now been replicated in a number of different studies. This is just another person's data, just to show you the consistency of that sort of basic shape. But you can see, by contrast, this is the shape that I've been showing you. This is the decrease in the an estimate of the volume of the frontal cortex, showing this precipitous drop. And this was true in the subcortical structures as well. But in the hippocampus, for reasons that we don't understand, the volume appears to continue at least to a very modestly increase in volume until much later, and then only to decline in volume later on. So I've told you a lot about reports that have come out suggesting that there are these volume decreases in the gray matter structures in the brain, and you might be wondering, well, why don't teenagers have very shriveled up atrophied brains? And the reason for this, of course, is that concurrently with all these changes are changes in the volume of the cerebral white matter. Now, presumably, these are just some data from my lab with the same age range, and presumably this is related to what we know is ongoing differentiation of oligodendrocytes and continuing deposition of myelin as these oligodendrocytes wrap the myelin sheath around the axons in the brain's fiber tracts. Now, let me just summarize. For the first couple or two or three decades of life, clearly age-related tissue alterations of some kind, presumably related to brain maturation, can be observed with these morphometric techniques. And although the first evidence for this came in the form of apparent changes in the morphology of gray matter structures, after all, that's what we were trying to measure, gray matter structures, it was suspected even then that much of the change that we were observing was probably either directly or indirectly related to continuing myelination in the brain and fiber tract development. And what do I mean when I say directly or indirectly? Well, first of all, let me remind you that when you're measuring the volume, for the apparent volume of gray matter structure on MRI, the signal that you exploit to do that is the difference, the contrast between the gray matter and the underlying white matter. And this is just a slide that I took from Anders Dale's lab because he shows the internal and the external surface of the cortex and points out that really it's the signal difference between the two that you use to try to estimate the boundary and volume of the structure. Now, if the underlying white matter is relatively unmyelinated, then obviously, well, it is the presence of the myelin that produces the signal contrast. And so if the underlying white matter is relatively unmyelinated, and especially if it is so out near the cortex, the inside surface of the cortex, then this unmyelinated white matter may segment, so to speak, as gray matter. And so clearly, some of what we're measuring as cortical thinning can be late myelination of these very superficial parts of the white matter structure, so that the signal values that were originally more similar to gray become more similar to white as myelination proceeds out to the cortex. So that's what I mean when I say directly related to ongoing myelination. It's quite difficult with MR morphometry to sort of figure out exactly how much is of what you're observing is that. And clearly in younger children, this is a part of what you're measuring. And when I say indirectly, I mean that even then we thought, well, perhaps somehow the functional development that is occurring in brain fiber tracts as myelination proceeds is an important part of the functional trigger for changes that are actually intrinsic to the cortex. Triggers, in other words, increasing activity in these neural circuits or a change in the activity in these neural circuits associated with myelination may change the neuropil by stimulating changes in synaptic density or dendritic structure or something like that that actually lead to real regressive changes in the cortex. But the problem was that at that time, there really was no place to take these kinds of questions because we really had no way of investigating in detail the structure of the cerebral white matter. And of course, all that changed when diffusion tensor imaging came along. And I'm sure most of you guys know about diffusion tensor imaging, but just briefly, it measures the diffusion or motion of protons in water molecules in the brain. And you can model the direction of proton motion within a voxel by computing a tensor. And since there are lots of mathematicians in the audience, I know you guys all know what tensors are. But this is important because proton diffusion tends to be relatively isotropic in gray matter. That is to say, it doesn't have a preferred direction. It's kind of random directionally. Whereas the linear structure of brain fiber tracts constrains proton diffusion and produces what is called anisotropy. And I'll show you a little more about that here, just for those of you who are not imaging folks. Okay. And this is a slide that I stole from Guido Gehrig, who was kind enough to send it to me. But I like it because it shows these little pictures of the depictions of the graphical depictions of the tensor. And you can see that these are the kinds of images that you get from DTI. This is just an image showing the apparent diffusion coefficient or the mean diffusivity. This is kind of the total amount of diffusion that's in the voxel that's being mapped here in the brain, or the tensor size, if you will. And here you can see that because there's free water in the ventricles in the brain, there's a lot of diffusion, so diffusion is very high. But in the tissues of the brain, there's constraint on the movement of the protons, so the diffusion of the protons, and so diffusion is low. Of more interest is this measure of fractional anisotropy, which is basically the degree of directionality that you observe in the tensor, or the elongation of the tensor shown here. And you can see here that when you map fractional anisotropy, which is the usual measure of this elongation, you can see a lot of signal and a lot of structure in the brain's fiber tracts. This is a fractional anisotropy map here. Okay, now what's interesting for our purposes is that if you look at this parameter, I'm going to show you here fractional anisotropy, and I didn't show you kids younger than 12 months of age, although there are very dramatic changes there. But if you look at these maps in kids who are developing, this is 1, 2, 3, and 4-year-old kids, you can see that these high FA values are primarily limited to the commissural and major sensory motor tracts early on, and that you begin to see higher FA values going out into the cortical regions, into the association tracts and cortical association fibers out here as development proceeds. And these are just some color-coded images to point out that you can, in addition to looking at the elongation of the tensor, you have information about the directionality of the fibers, of the net fiber orientation within the voxel. And so you can make a reasonable guess as to which direction the fiber tracts are coursing. And here they're color-coded so that those that appear to be coursing front to back are in green. The ones that are coursing side to side are coded in red. And the ones that are coursing through the section are shown in blue. Okay, now let's look now at a somewhat later part of the age range, the school age kids. And a number of studies have emerged now, and this is just one of the early ones from the Stanford group, which used a sort of what's called a voxel-based morphometry technique to look at age effects in kids 6 to 19 years old for FA maps, spatially normalized FA maps. And these little white blobs are just clusters where they were able to detect an apparently significant age increase over this age range in FA. And the main message is just that there are lots of places in the brain where there appears to be increasing FA over this age range, continuing increases in FA over this age range. Now, as I say, there have been a number of these studies, but I'm going to review one that I think is a particularly good one that gives you kind of frames what we know about fiber tract development and the major fiber tracts so far. Now, I mentioned that you have information about the directionality of the tracts, and this information can be exploited in a group of techniques that are referred to as streamlining or tractography to identify voxels in the FA map or in the diffusion maps that are very likely to be in the major fiber tracts that are known to exist in the brain from earlier anatomical studies and animal studies and so on. And so people have done this. They've used these tractography methods to try to identify the locations of major known fiber tracts in the brain, and these are just some of them shown here in this slide from Christian Boyeau's lab. This paper is published, but I like the slides better from the presentation, so I'm going to go through those. But but you can see, you can identify those fiber tracts, and then you can estimate the FA in the fiber tract, or the mean diffusivity, or the principal eigenvalues of the different diffusivities in the fiber tracts. And so I'm going to show you some of those data from Christian Boyeau's lab, because he has this wonderful data set, just about the best one, I think, out there so far, of kids, of individuals between 5 and 35 years of age, looking at FA now in these different fiber tracts. And when he did that, he identified a number of fiber tracts that he described as rapidly developing. That is to say, FA reached approximately 90% of maximum or asymptotic FA values before age 11, but you can still see quite a dramatic change from 5 to 11. Other tracts that were showing a more protracted developmental course, only reaching 90% of maximum FA somewhere between 15 and 17 years, including the superior longitudinal vesiculus here, connecting posterior temporal and parietal regions to the frontal lobe. And even a couple of tracts, interestingly, in the limbic system, the cingulum and the uncinate here, that showed an even slower developmental course and really haven't obviously hit asymptote yet, but clearly it's past age 20. Okay, so what's happening here? Well, we don't really know exactly what's happening here, but this is kind of a cartoon that is sort of a working hypothesis about what's going on. This is meant to be a depiction of a cross-section of an immature fiber tract and a cross-section of a more mature fiber tract, where the circles here are the axons and the little dots are free water molecules in the extra-axonal space. And you can see here there are a lot of these free water molecules, and those are thought to diffuse sort of randomly, directionally, and there's a lot of that space, so there's a lot of diffusion because there's a lot of free water there. And so the individual diffusivities, if you think of these as being the three eigenvalues from the tensor, all the diffusivities are high in this case. With maturity, you see an increase in the diameter of the axons, either because the axons actually increase in caliber or because, more likely, there's more myelin wrapped around them, and so there's less of this water in the extra-axonal space. And so all three of the diffusivities go down, but because there's less reduction in the diffusivity along the long axis of the fiber tracts, possibly because there may actually be some increase in the axoplasmic flow, though this is not really well established, this diffusivity goes down less than these do, and so FA increases. So that's kind of the idea about what might be going on. Okay, now just to show you that these are some data from my lab, from kids in a Danish study that I'm going to talk more about later. But this just to show you that just as that predicts, from 7 to 13 years of age, we observe this increase in fractional anisotropy just ignore that figure except to say that in the fiber tracts, which is associated with a modest reduction in parallel diffusivity, that's this one, relative to a somewhat steeper reduction in perpendicular diffusivity, which is these. Okay. All right, now, to summarize, although the changes may be visually subtle, If you examine it closely, the brain exhibits a very complex pattern of age-associated tissue alterations of some kind well into adulthood, and we're just beginning really to understand the relationship between these changes and developing cognition. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know, and I'm just going to give you a very selective, just to hit a couple of studies that I think are particularly interesting, and I have to start with this one because it was the first one and we did it. And this was back when we only knew about the gray matter changes. And these are data from Elizabeth Sowell's dissertation. And these are our estimates of the frontal lobe volume. That's the whole thing up here. And these were Elizabeth's subjects in her dissertation right here. And you can see, first of all, what struck us was the enormous amount of individual difference variability, even among these young children, 8 to 10 years of age. And so the question in the dissertation was whether this was related to developing memory function. And because we were doing this with Dean Dellis, who developed the California Verbal Learning Test for Children, we knew from the standardization sample that what changed over this age range in these kids was the efficiency of their memory retrieval processes. Now, their recognition is actually essentially is great already at 7, but their retrieval processes get more efficient. And so we looked at measures of memory retrieval, free recall, and we tried to link it to this variability. And what we found is that even if you controlled for chronological age, the kids who had thinner or more mature cortical volumes, lower cortical volumes, frontal cortical volumes, showed better memory retrieval abilities. So we interpreted this to mean that even among kids of the same age, some kids might be at a somewhat more advanced stage of biological development of the frontal cortex, and that this was somehow related to their memory retrieval abilities. Anyway, since that time, there have been a couple of other studies. This is another one by Elizabeth at UCLA, showing, again, the same sample that was truly a longitudinal sample, showing that even if you look within subjects, you can see that, for example, the degree of thickening in this area that I showed you before showed thickening. The degree of thickening was correlated with the degree of phonological processing improvement over this two-year period in these kids, in this inferior frontal region. And at the same time, the degree of thinning of this cortex, this dorsal motor cortex here, was related to improvements, the degree of improvement in fine motor skill in these kids. But what about these changes in the brain fiber tracts? Now, to tell you the truth, there are a lot more findings coming out relating variability in the brain, in the DTI parameters to performance variability than there were for the gray matter changes. I don't know exactly why that is, but there are a lot of them, and I don't have time to talk about them all. But I'm going to give you a couple of them to just highlight what the findings are. This is an early one in infants, which I think is particularly interesting because it shows that in 5 to 17-week-old infants, the degree of myelination is assessed with FA in the optic radiations was associated with the latency of the P1 component of the visual evoked potential. But looking at the findings in older kids, what we're beginning to see now is a number of studies looking at things like individual differences in developing children on reading fluency, for example, or reading ability, and working memory ability, and things like that. And this is one of my favorites. It's from Bruce McCandless's lab, and it's because he really tried to look at the question of the specificity of these findings. It was just an early attempt to do so. But here what he looked at was he found a cluster in the superior corona radiata, in these ascending fibers of the corona radiata, in which FA was associated with individual differences in his kids, which were, I think, 6 to 10-year-old kids, on this sort of quick and dirty measure of reading fluency. But he didn't see any association between FA there and this measure of verbal working memory, which is standard digit recall. On the other hand, when he looked at a cluster more anteriorly in the anterior corona radiata, he saw that FA there seemed to be associated with variability on the working memory task, but showed no association to the reading fluency measure. Now, this may seem a little bit surprising that you would find a correlation between reading ability and fiber structure in the superior corona radiata, but actually it's been observed in, I think, three or four studies now. And so for some reason, that does appear to be a fairly reliable finding. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some findings from my own laboratory in a study that I've been conducting in Denmark, where we're doing a longitudinal study of 7 to 13-year-old kids with SMRI, DTI, and some cognitive testing there repeatedly every 6 months. And I'm going to talk about the baseline data. And I really vacillated about how to present these findings because we've really been approaching, we've been measuring about three or four basic behavioral constructs in the study and trying to link fiber tract development to variability on these different behavioral tasks. And if I present the sort of univariate findings, I think it's going to be hard for me to give you the picture of that's evolving for us about the results here. So I'm going to do a very risky thing. I'm going to try to present the results of a partial least squares analysis to try to sort of put it to give you a better global picture of the relationships that we're observing. But we'll see if this succeeds. In a group of mathematicians like this, I'm probably making a big mistake. But anyway, first let me say that the way we approached the DTI data here was to use a method called track-based spatial statistics, which is a part of the FSL suite, to do the spatial normalization for us. That is, to try to establish homology between the different fiber tracts from one individual child to the next. So we used it for spatial normalization. And I'm not going to go into the details of it, but basically it establishes a fiber track skeleton, as you see here, and brings these fiber track skeleta into alignment from one individual child to the next. And then we use the group mean skeletons from TBSS to actually define regions of interest. Because what we're interested in was estimating FA in a particular segment of a fiber tract. We weren't interested in the voxel-wise variability. We were interested in estimating FA in a particular part of a particular fiber tract. So we used a kind of hybrid ROI approach with these skeletons, and we defined these four basic ROIs: the corticospinal tract, which is shown here in orange, the superior longitudinal fasciculus, shown here in green, the dorsolateral prefrontal, the fiber tracts that go into the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, shown here, and the ones going into the inferior frontal gyrus, shown here. And these are just some representative images so you get some idea what this is. So we could estimate FA in these different ROIs, parts of the fiber structure of the brain. Okay, so here's my partial least squares analysis. Now, what I'm going to show you is the results when we did this with using the FA in these four ROIs as four separate variables to predict the following four behavioral measures. First, we looked at just five-choice reaction time, just a standard five-choice reaction time measure. We were also very much interested in this measure of response inhibition. This is a classic response inhibition task, the stop signal reaction time task. It just involves, without me going into a lot of detail, just involves estimating the amount of time it takes the kid to withhold a prepotent motor response. So they're primed to make a motor response, then they get a signal, they have to withhold that response, and we can estimate with an adaptive sort of testing mechanism how long it takes them to reliably stop. And then a measure of spatial working memory, which is sort of a self-ordered search task, where the kids are trying to find hidden boxes underneath different locations. And then a standard verbal fluency task, just letters and categories. Okay, so we're going to predict these with the four ROIs. And now, how do you present? Anybody who's done partial least squares knows that it's not a straightforward description, but basically, the results actually are pretty straightforward for partial least squares analysis. What happens with partial least squares is that the analysis finds the latent vectors in this that define the covariation between these two sets of variables and computes these vectors. And the first one is, as the first one always is, a global vector, which basically loads positively on all the performance measures and positively on all the FA measures. So overall, task performance is related to increased FA in this sample of kids. And that's sort of just that the plot of that latent X variable versus that latent Y variable. That's good, but not very interesting. What's more interesting, I think, are the second and third latent vectors, which suggest, in this case, that a pattern of relative performance, the performance in the verbal fluency task relative to the response inhibition task was related to a pattern relating the FA in these dorsally lined tracts, the SLF, the superior longitudinal fasciculus, and the parts going into the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, to the inferior frontal gyrus. which is very interesting because this region of the inferior frontal gyrus has been strongly implicated in response inhibition in other studies, and our univariate analyses bear this out as well. But anyway, what you're seeing here is something that goes beyond this global relationship between FA and performance variability and suggests that there is individual difference variability, that kids who are doing better in verbal fluency than response inhibition show a particular pattern in the FA and their fiber tracts, whereas kids who are doing better at response inhibition than verbal fluency show a different pattern in their FA. And this is a third one, which just is not surprising. This just shows that independent of all this, kids who have relatively better reaction time, choice reaction time performance, have relatively higher FA in the cortical spinal tract, which is reassuring. Yes?
So the kids in the upper right can't stop talking?
Yeah, maybe. Could be that. I mean, it's an interesting question. Anyway, I don't want to make too much of these partial least squares now, so I was just trying to give you in one go kind of an idea of the pattern that is emerging, and this is consistent with what we're seeing in the univariate analyses where we're trying to look at each construct separately. But just to summarize, there is significant age effects, by the way, I don't think I mentioned this, for all these behavioral measures and for all the tract FA measures over this age range. But independent of age and global effects in FA, there appear to be individual differences in behavioral profiles that are mirrored by individual differences in the tract FA profiles, if you will. That's kind of the bottom line that I'm trying to convey with this analysis. So how do we interpret these these associations? Well, first of all, we have to ask the question, are the relationships due to the effects of developmental variability? And what do I mean by that? Well, I want to point out that most all of these associations are there even when you control for chronological age. So how could you get such associations? Well, if you think of this as being the hypothetical developmental curve for, say, the biological development of a particular fiber tract, if kids look like this, if they all showed the same curve and there was very close temporal, so that kids of a certain age all showed the same phase on these curves, when you control for chronological age, you couldn't get these kinds of associations due to this kind of variability. However, if kids, even if they show the same curve of development in fiber tracts, at least as measured by FA, if there were differences in the phase, if kids of a certain age were at different phases in this curve, then you could see these kinds of associations, and it might be due to the fact that some kids just were at a more advanced stage of development relative to other kids, and this was the variability that was mediating these associations between FA and performance variability in these kids. Of course, there's no reason to think that these curves are all shaped alike. They could be highly idiosyncratically shaped. Each child could have a very unique developmental trajectory. But again, even controlling for chronological age, this kind of variability could account for the kinds of associations that people are reporting in developing kids. On the other hand, we could be observing something that's much more like this. In this case, the kids may have the same curve. They may be at the same phase at the same age, but they may simply have different underlying connectivity that is reflected in different FA values. And this kind of variability would also give you the kinds of associations that we're seeing that remain when you control for chronological age. And these kinds of effects have been shown in adults that you can see differences in FA associated with underlying brain connectivity. So this is one of the important questions that we haven't yet addressed in this literature. And beyond this, independent of whether you think the effects are more like the developmental cases I showed above or the more stable cases below, it begs the question what role intrinsic, for example, genetic factors may have in setting these different parameters versus extrinsic factors or experience. For example, shall we interpret these things to mean that, for example, that in children who are practicing a lot or, for example, reading more, driving activity in the reading circuits more, are propelling or accelerating the development of the fiber tracts that mediate that task? Or should we think of them more as differences in time constants that kind of come out of genetic variability, just like sort of there's sort of heritability to when you grow your height, there may be some heritability to when you grow your fiber tracts, so to speak. It's just an open question. And how do these things interact? Here's the question that I think is important, and that is, Does the effect of experience, for example, practice or instruction, vary as a function of the phase of biological development? And is this an important reason that there's behavioral phenotypic variability? Okay, so I just want to point out that we are pursuing these questions with some support from the TDLC in a new pilot study that has been supported to Paula Talal and to some of the other affiliated investigators in the TDLC, where we're beginning to study kids at baseline and follow-up with cognitive measures of temporal processing as well as spatial and linguistic and numerical processing with SMRI, DTI, and MEG. And in between, in the interval between baseline and follow-up, they're going to be participating in a behavioral intervention program aimed at improving rapid auditory processing. And I think Paula will probably say more about this later, but this is just a pilot study to begin to pursue some of these questions about the sort of plasticity in these trajectories and the relationship between the trajectories and learning and cognitive development in this year. Okay, so this is back to my title slide. Hopefully I'm doing okay, but I'm almost finished. Remember I said I was going to try to talk about the role of timing, and I wish I could talk more about the role of timing, but I think these are really the critical questions that relate to timing about these associations. First of all, I think we don't yet know, although it's often assumed that we do, whether these associations between fiber tract parameters and performance variability have anything to do with the increased speed of conduction within the fiber tracts. I mean, I think people often make the assumption that these effects are mediated by the fact that better myelinated tracts show more rapid transmission of information through the tracts, and that this is why there are these functional correlates. But that actually has not been very well established. It's not clear what role speed of conduction per se has in mediating these associations. At a different time scale entirely is this question that I've been talking about most of the talk, which is, are these associations mediated by individual differences in the individual time course for each child in their fiber tract development, in the phase of biological development of the fiber tracts? That really has not been answered by any of these associations so far, and it's an important question. And then finally, this is another question about timing, and actually embedded within this point are what I think are two separate interesting questions about the temporal sequence of development of different fiber tracts. Because I think it's important for us to understand whether it matters if the fiber tracts in one neural system are relatively more advanced than in another neural system. Does this relationship between the trajectories and those two systems have implications itself? That is, are there competitive effects that occur when a child has one neural system sort of in a more advanced state of biological development than another, or vice versa? And this is a different question, and it's a broader question embedded within this one, and that is, and I think I've heard Terry Sanofsky say a few things like that are sort of similar to this. Is it important, if you think of these later cortical-cortical association tracks as this later development in those tracks, as being kind of a late entry of particular stations in neural circuits after there has been more functional specialization and development in the earlier developing parts of the neural system. This late entry of new stations in the circuit or late development of some circuits and some stations in the circuit, does this have important implications computationally? So is this an important part of how we develop very high levels of expertise, more abstract representations? Is the timing, is this staging of fiber tract development an important way that higher level expertise develops? Is this computationally important? I guess is a more general sort of philosophical question, if you will, that I think is interesting that these kind of findings raise. Okay, so my conclusions are that there is clearly evidence that biological development of brain tissues continues throughout childhood and adolescence and into early adulthood. And you can link the variability in these biological changes to individual differences in behavior in developing children. Unfortunately, very little is presently known about the meaning of these associations, and particularly about the roles of genes, experience, and other environmental factors in mediating these associations. So I'd like to thank the people at the Danish Medical Magnetic Resonance Research Department, where I did the Danish studies, and the people in the Laboratory of Cognitive Imaging here at UCSD. And of course, I'd like to thank you.
Start. The reason that Katie and I are walking around with microphones is not that we like sashaying up and down the aisles, and we know that you can all project in this room, but for the people afterwards who want to actually see this, if you don't use the microphone, it doesn't go on tape, so it'll be this large black hole in the transcript. So if you could just wait until somebody comes with a mic, that'd be very helpful.
Thank you. Very interesting set of data. One of the things that you mentioned at the end there is the notion that increase in the speed of conduction might be an important factor. I think since all of us are interested in the timing of neural events, one of the things that I think also is likely to be very important is the coincidence or synchronicity of the input going into these centers. So one of the things that I suspect is also happening is a greater coherence of the neural signals as you get myelination, which could improve signal-to-noise ratios and a variety of other impacts in terms of how those systems operate behaviorally.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I can't really comment on it except to say that I have this sort of analogy that I have in my head, which is that the biological development of these fiber tracks sort of allows them to sing with the choir. And I think this sort of evokes a little bit your idea that it's not just speed per se, but allowing these tracks, the parts of the neural system that are connected by these tracks to begin to participate more in the singing that's going on in the nervous system. Thank you.
Yeah. So early in your talk, you pointed out how one possible reason for the thinning cerebral mantle is the myelination right up close to the underside.
Right.
Do you think that is predominantly in local corticocortical circuits?
That's a great question because I think there's enough evidence to say that, you know, it looks like the primary sensory motor tracts myelinate first, and then you get these long projection tracts that begin to myelate, and then these long association fibers that then seem to have a later level, you know, later development. But the local circuit U-fibers and corticocortical fibers, not as much is known about them, about the time course of the development of those fibers. And people are just beginning to develop techniques. A couple of papers just recently came out, techniques for trying to isolate them. They're a little bit tougher to isolate, and there are a lot of them. So I think, you know, that's a good question. We don't know how plausible it is that thinning is related to the myelination of those underlying, but it's certainly a reasonable thing, possibility.
So where do you think synaptic pruning and so where there might be reductions in connectivity might play a role into the kind of things that you guys can see?
Well, of course, from the very outset, people have thought maybe this is related to synaptic pruning, and certainly we know from animal studies and so on, that there is some significant reduction of synaptic density and across development and in probably across the adolescent time period and so on. I think it's likely. I think it's very hard to say for sure this has anything to do with synaptic pruning, but I think it's quite likely that the functional development that comes with the biological development of fiber tracts does begin to select certain connections much more strongly relative to other ones, and that there will be sculpting of synaptic structures and dendritic structures and also of axonal structures in association with that. But I don't know that we can really say that except to speculate about it. Thanks.